From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the halls of Fox News, where longtime leader Roger Ailes wanted to make a change in regards to anchor Gretchen Carlson. Ailes called for Carlson's work to be cut back. She would no longer do big interviews. She would be taken off the popular Fox and Friends morning show, where she had been a fixture. According to a lawsuit, Ailes also cut Carlson's pay. What was going on? Well, to hear Roger Ailes tell it, Carlson was not performing well on air. But Carlson tells a very different story. In her lawsuit, Carlson claims that Roger Ailes has been sexually harassing her for years, at times overtly indicating that if she slept with him, she would have a much more successful career. Carlson repeatedly denied his advances, she says, and when Ailes heard about her concerns, well, that is when she was punished and eventually removed from her show. Carlson was fired last month, but Carlson's legal efforts were well underway. She made her allegations public, and Fox News responded by releasing handwritten notes from Carlson to Ailes, some including smiley faces and turns of phrase that indicate affection. The implication was clear. Why would Carlson say nice things about a man who had harassed her? Well, at first, Fox employees rallied to Ailes' side. But then star anchor Megyn Kelly reportedly made her own allegations that a decade ago, Ailes had harassed her in similar fashion. And Kelly's claim was greeted with the chorus of Fox staffers pointing to glowing comments she had made about Ailes, even thanking him for promoting women over the years. Why, they asked, would Megyn Kelly praise her boss if he had harassed her? By now you know that Carlson and Kelly were followed by other women who made similar claims, and Ailes was forced to resign. It's important to point out here that he has maintained his innocence in this case, but this hour we want to address the dynamics behind sexual harassment at large and why some victims do choose to stay and work, sometimes for years. Let me welcome my guest now. Beth Cordello's here. She's chair of the Employment Law Practice with Polano & Farrow here in Rochester. And Beth, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And Jack Tuckner is on the line with us. He's an attorney focusing on women's rights in the workplace and founding partner of one of the first firms to focus its practice on workplace gender rights. Jack, welcome to you as well. All right, let me start with you, Beth. Let's start with just the question of your reaction to the broader question here. And you've handled, I imagine, dozens, if not hundreds, of these kinds of cases. Is that correct?
Hundreds,
yes. On both sides, for potential sexual harassment victims and for employers?
That's correct.
Okay, so in generally speaking, you've probably seen this kind of case many times, yes?
Many, many times.
What did you think when you saw it hit the news here?
It's the dynamics here are so typical in this situation where the complainant does have a rapport with the accused, does try to get along and be a quote-unquote team player. Ultimately, it doesn't work out, complains, and is retaliated against.
Okay. So you've seen it before.
Yes.
And we're going to work through with you and with Jack the questions that a lot of people have been asking. You know, why would they say nice things? Why would they stay for years? Because I know there's not just one answer to that. Jack, what did you make of it when you heard the story come out?
Well, you know, it's also, as an attorney who handles these cases all the time, seeing it from... This is not probably the best, you know, poster sort of for spokesmodels for plaintiffs. I don't know that, you know, Gretchen Carlson and Megyn Kelly, this is sort of an outlier case. So probably Beth and I see this more often with people who aren't earning seven-figure salaries and who don't get to just sue the individual person and not the company. So, I mean, I think also I didn't make much of it other than it's was an excuse for this to play on Fox News and to get everyone's attention, and maybe that's a good thing. But I don't think there's really anything about this that is very different other than the status of these people involved, that they're not the average woman who is suffering in this type of a situation. So in that sense, it's probably way worse for the people that we represent on a day-to-day basis.
And Jack, I suspect throughout this hour, I may sort of slip into referring to victims as women. I know victims can be both genders. From your perspective, the vast majority are women?
Yes.
Fair enough. Beth, same?
Vast majority are women. Occasionally, men will suffer sexual harassment, or sometimes the harasser is a female as well.
Okay. So for listeners, I mean, I don't seek to stereotype it, but we're just looking at from what we've seen by experience, that's why if you hear it described that way. Let's take it from a number of different angles. I want to start with what you might have seen yesterday, Chuck Todd talking to Donald Trump. Donald Trump's thoughts on Roger Ailes, who might even end up running Donald Trump's campaign, according to Donald Trump's son. Here's what Trump said about Roger Ailes and these claims of sexual harassment.
He's been a friend of mine for a long time, and I can tell you that some of the women that are complaining, I know how much he's helped them, and even recently, and when they write books that are fairly recently released, and they say wonderful things about him, and now all of a sudden they're saying these horrible things about him, it's very sad. Because he's a very good person. I've always found him to be just a very, very good person. And by the way, a very, very talented person. Look what he's done.
Okay. I'll start with you, Jack. That kind of remark is reflective of a lot of the doubt we're hearing expressed by people who say, well, they've said nice things. It's coming from a potential next president. What did you make of that remark?
Well, first of all, consider the source. It's Donald Trump. And this is, you know, this is a man who recently I saw a 10-second video where he was appalled that the remake of the Ghostbusters had three women in the starring roles. I said, what's the world coming to? You know, Donald Trump coming to his aid and saying that he's a nice person and it's sad doesn't address the merits. I'm not sure it doesn't really compute that he may be a nice person to Donald Trump. Does that implicate issues of whether or not he's guilty? I mean, if that's what people are thinking, I'm not sure that there's really a correlation there that Donald Trump finds him to be a nice man.
But Beth, when I hear this remark from Trump, I mean, I understand Jack's point very well. I also think about how potential victims might feel. And to Jack's point, I mean, maybe these are sort of outlier cases where they're making a lot more money than the average sexual harassment victim would be making. But I still think if you are a victim of harassment and you hear a high-profile person essentially maligning you for raising a case because he likes the person who's being accused, does that make it harder for victims, potential future victims, to want to come forward when they hear this kind of response? What do you think?
Well, absolutely. When someone is well-respected, well-known in the community, is absolutely at the top echelon of the business, you know you're going to have a hard time being believed. And, you know, to also respond to what Donald Trump had to say, I agree with Jack. I have no doubt in my mind that Roger Ailes has promoted women over the years, has done nice things. That doesn't change the fact that you can be those things and also be someone right. Who propositions women in the workplace. This isn't you're either all bad or all good. Bad people do good things and vice versa.
Okay. And then on the subject of some of what has been written. Here's Callum Borchers writing in the Washington Post last week. Quote, Megyn Kelly has told investigators hired by 21st Century Fox that Roger Ailes made unwanted advances a decade ago, bolstering allegations made in a sexual harassment lawsuit brought by Gretchen Carlson. But if that's true, why did she tell Variety in April that, quote, I really like working for Roger Ailes? And why would the woman who earned widespread praise for her resolve in the face of Donald Trump's insults during the Republican presidential primary put up with that kind of crap? It just doesn't make sense, or does it? Kelly did write in a memoir published last year that, quote, we seem to have a real connection, end quote. That's from Callum Borchers writing in the Washington Post. All right, Jack and Beth, let's walk through this. If you've been harassed, and it doesn't have to be a high-profile case, a Fox News anchor, could be anybody in any workplace. Let's work through the reasons why someone who's been harassed would stay. Jack, what stands out to you as reason number one why people would stay?
Economic, pure and simple. First, second, and third. This is extremely nuanced, and I'm someone who understands, you know, that I enjoy male privilege and white privilege and lawyer privilege, so I don't know what it's like other than as an attorney representing almost exclusively women who find themselves in these situations. It's just not so easy to tell your boss, if you're in the position to say, you hit on me, you subjected me to unwelcome advances that I find insulting or disrespectful, so I'm going to quit. I'm going to walk away from my $2.5 million salary. It's challenging, and I think most people want to go along to get along in the culture that they're in, so they do everything they can to bend over backwards to try to work with that, to hope that it will change, to be nice to the powers that be. We're not talking about, you know, we're not talking about Bill Cosby. I think that there was a conflation, or I read something just this morning about he may be becoming, or can there be 20 women that came forward apparently. to say that they were sexually harassed by Roger Ailes in the workplace. It wasn't quite the sexual abuse, molestation, or a sex crime as Mr. Cosby has been accused of. So I think there are lots of nuances to when push comes to shove and when someone finally says, I've had it. And that's a very individual, it's a very individual thing.
Okay. Beth?
Well, there's a couple of things that stand out to me. First, oftentimes the person who's been harassed does have some type of rapport with the harasser. And they say, you know, women I've counseled have said to me, you know, I really like so-and-so. I just wish he would stop hitting on me. If I could just get him to stop hitting on me, you know, I think that this business relationship could be great. So they're trying to reconcile the fact that here's somebody I respect who is making me feel as though I have to engage in a sexual relationship or put up with some sexual banter in order to get along in the workplace that makes me uncomfortable. And they'll try every other way to get around it because, as Jack says, economics, when I counsel women and they're in this situation and they're trying to figure out what to do, you know, to be honest, once you've accused your employer of this type of illegal conduct, it damages the relationship irreparably. So, you know, we start looking at, you know, what are your job prospects, you know, if you get retaliated against and fired? You know, can you support your children? And oftentimes, you know, they have to decide to put up with it until maybe they can do something else just because it's not feasible to go the legal route. They're not all Gretchen Carlson that can get the ear of the nation and the front pages of the paper and the support of, you know, all these people. They're, you know, people like you and I. That don't have that at their disposal. So as Jack says, it can often just be an economic question. I can't afford to not have this job right now.
And Beth, I think you make another important point here, because for those of us taking a look at this front page, as you say, a front page story, and you look at Roger Ailes, it's easy to feel like it's a cartoonish situation. Some have raised the comparison of Dabney Coleman and 9 to 5, you know, this employer who's sort of obviously aggressive, as opposed to the way you put it, which is that there's plenty of harassment that happens and the person on the receiving end of it still has an appreciation for the boss or doesn't look at them as a monster per se and wants it to stop so they can sort of continue at work for a number of reasons. But I guess what I'm saying is we have to not turn this situation into a cartoon, because life isn't typically like that, yes?
Right. And I'll also say that a knee-jerk reaction many women have is that maybe I've done something to send the wrong message, or, you know, maybe I've somehow encouraged this, and, you know, so they're sort of taking the blame onto themselves to figure out what they could have done differently. Why are they being singled out in this way, which is unfortunate.
Jack, what do you think about that?
I'm sorry, which part of that?
Well, I mean, just the question on the way women or a receiver of sexual harassment may first have an instinct to ask if they have done something wrong. I mean, has that been expressed to you before?
Oh, continuously. And I think, I mean, it's a natural reaction, and I think women sort of tend to question themselves in that regard frequently. And also, you notice, Evan, it's never a subordinate. It's always, it's not as, you know, here when you're looking at someone like Roger Ailes, who these women can say, this man did help us, he did support me to become the extremely successful person that I am, with many, many things to be grateful for. And if along the way, one of the things that they're complaining about now is that he thought, Roger Ailes thought, that he should get an additional benefit of being really, really nice to them. And that's what he said, if you believe Gretchen Carlson and others, that he thought that he should get a perk from them. And that, when, and he apparently was somewhat relentless at it, but it didn't cost them their jobs for a time. And women certainly express regularly that if I can keep putting someone off, if I'm being paid X number of dollars and love my career, but I have to sort of deal with a certain amount of negative male energy. And when I say that, right, it can be just one day it's a little bit of a flirtation or something, and it's a little bit creepy and makes me need to want to take a shower. And sometimes it's a little bit more than that. And sometimes, but I just keep putting him off. And as long as I don't have to do anything, I'm never sleeping with him, right? Neither of them had to actually perform. So they must have felt and that this was the sort of the cost of doing business. And we all do this in some ways, compromise in our day-to-day lives. And women, of course, have to deal with this almost exclusively to what men have to deal with in that type of objectification and sexualization at work. But I don't think it is a pure thing. It's like, oh, Roger Ailes finds me attractive, so I'm going to sue him. I mean, again, it's also way more complicated than that, because when that happens at work and you're being sexually harassed, let's say, again, Roger Ailes is coming on to you, from a lawyer perspective at that point, you don't really have what lawyers call damages, right? You don't, what was the harm is he's hitting on me, but he's not threatening to fire you, he's not canceling your show, he's not conditioning it explicitly on some promotional advancement, let's say. So you feel that this is just part of the cost of doing business in your world. And you can understand how someone would say, I don't wish to throw out the baby with the bathwater every time something happens like this that feels a little bit icky.
Listeners, if you want to join with questions or comments of your own about the dynamics of sexual harassment, we'd love to hear from you. It's 844-295-TALK, and the number is toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You're hearing Jack Tuckner. He's an attorney focusing on women's rights in the workplace and a founding partner of one of the first firms to focus its practice on workplace gender rights. And Beth Cordello, chair of the employment law practice with Polano & Farrow here in Rochester. We'll get to your calls coming up here. A couple of other quick points to get to. We had an email from a listener this morning who was asking if the guests on this show think that there was a moral imperative for someone like Megyn Kelly to come forward with this instead of saying nice things about Roger Ailes for years, because we're talking about why receivers of harassment would stay with a company. But one of our listeners this morning sent a note saying they want to know if our guests today think Megyn Kelly's a little bit more privileged, she's got more money and more power, and if she says nothing, are others going to be treated similarly? Did she have any moral imperative? I mean, Beth, is that fair or unfair to ask that question?
I suppose it's fair, and with Megyn Kelly, I guess she apparently told investigators, that she was sexually harassed, and if that's so.
10 years ago, though.
10 years
ago.
My
understanding, yeah. At least, and again, I'm sort of speaking out of school here. I certainly don't know all the details, but it seems to me that what she's saying now is this happened about a decade ago, but she didn't spend a decade trying to root this out, or at least she didn't spend the last 3 to 5 years trying to root this out as she rose to stardom.
So, right. And she could have totally towed the Roger Ailes line, especially with, everything that's gone on this past year, with her moderating the debates and Donald Trump and all of this. And Fox was very supportive in that regard. If she in fact been harassed by Roger Ailes, and she's supporting Gretchen Carlson now, and she has nothing personally to gain from it, only criticism and praise for some, then I think it's because she felt morally obligated to do so.
Okay. Jack, any moral obligation on Megyn Kelly's part?
I don't think so, because, when you look at the context of this, the question can be sort of drawn further into, does she have a moral imperative not to report on Fox News? We're talking about Fox News. I think if I were picking a jury and I had Gretchen Carlson or Megyn Kelly and during voir dire, I don't know that I would pick either of them, and I don't think either one of them identifies feminists. And we're dealing with this. I mean, I think it matters. It matters what we're dealing with in terms of who the employer is and who these people are. So did she have a moral imperative 10 years ago? I don't think so, and I don't think it was even probably a question for her then. Well, now that she was asked a direct question, I'm very glad that she told the truth, or so she now alleges. But I don't know why she would have had, is a moral imperative for her sisters that are struggling, that she should have been someone to just stand up and be counted. I think as a practical matter, it's sort of probably asking too much.
Okay, well, and this leads me to go back to a piece I read last week in The New Yorker that had a paragraph that I don't know how I felt about it. And I thought, I'm just going to read this, what The New Yorker had here, and ask our guests to respond, because I think The New Yorker piece did a good job of working through some of the dynamics that we're talking about today. But then they had this paragraph, and I'm going to quote from The New Yorker, quote, "The women at Fox News do make a particular bargain. In theory, of course, sexual harassers can be found in any workplace, but it's easy to believe that they would flourish at a company where the fetishization of hot female news presenters is part of the business model. It isn't just that Fox hires attractive women as news anchors, that's a given on any network, but that the management apparently discourages those women from even wearing pants and has them seated so their legs are shown to maximum advantage in almost uniformly short skirts. And then, not infrequently, their male co-hosts point that out," end quote. That's it. That's the whole paragraph. And I don't know, Jack. I mean, I take the point, But I also don't want to blame a victim. So how do you feel about that?
I'm not. I think it was kind of along the lines that I was sort of alluding to, and I think that we sometimes have to sort of, you know, call a particular spade a spade. I don't know, and I don't know. I don't watch Fox News. I really don't know the politics of these individuals specifically, but of course that's true. There's a built-in objectification. I believe that Gretchen Carlson accused Steve Doocy as well. Now clips that you can see on YouTube of the many times she's appeared uncomfortable with her, you know, male when she was short shrifted or she's not being taken seriously or they make fun of her off camera. I think that part of having that look of this is the look of out there, everybody's a pretty model, former Miss America, it tends to set up a framework that is unbalanced. And women are valued on Fox News, are they not, for their looks in far greater sort of percentage than they are their substantive abilities or talents. So I'm certainly not blaming the victims, but is there a sort of a general complicity given who and what Fox News is? This is a station where people who listen to it regularly have, I understand, are less informed than people who don't watch the news at all. And I don't know. And I've had cases where that were in the media that Fox News and Megyn Kelly and I don't remember who else was on her show made fun of when a particular woman, you know, if there was any way for them to make fun of the claim, they did. So, you know, again, they deserve all of these. They deserve their day in court, and these cases will either be tried or settled. Roger Ailes got his nice $60 million severance package. these are really not the folks that we should be feeling sorry for. So to the extent that it raises consciousness, that's a good thing. It raises consciousness. I think Beth and I would both agree. Anything that raises awareness about, you know, about misogyny or sexism in the workplace can only be a good thing.
Well, and then expanding on that point, Beth Cordello, the Washington Post had an extended piece in which they tried to talk to people inside the company and try to get the take of people who've worked alongside an executive who has apparently been a harasser or allegedly been a harasser for years. And here's what a high-ranking Fox News executive told the Washington Post. Quote, "I look at Roger, it's like Mad Men." This guy came of age in the 50s, 60s, and 70s when it was a whole different culture. I don't think he was thinking that what he was saying was really all that bad, end quote. I mean, I really?
Right. Well, you'll hear that with, you know, racism as well. Well, grandpa doesn't know any better because he came up in this certain generation. I think that's basically what he's saying. And of course, it doesn't excuse it. There's no, you know, under the laws, there's no, well, if you're this age or older, you can't possibly know better, so you can't be held liable.
Okay. One more question for our guest before I turn to some of our listeners' questions. The New Yorker also said that there are obviously the economic reasons that our guests have discussed. Why would someone who's been harassed stay at work? And again, I'm not talking about seven-figure anchors. We're talking about mostly women, day-to-day workers in any company in America. Why would they stay? Economic, of course. But the New Yorker also writes that women want to avoid the career-trashing labels of whiner or troublemaker. Beth, do you agree with that?
Oh, I completely agree with that. You know, especially we'll take, you know, here in Rochester, for example, if you're in the broadcasting industry or the legal community or so on and so forth, everybody kind of knows one another. And, you know, if you're known as that person who filed that complaint, prospective employers, you know, it'll give them pause as to whether they would hire you. You know, if you file a lawsuit, that's public. Anyone can see it. You can Google it, and it's right there. And women are very mindful of that as well.
Okay, Jack, go ahead.
Right. It's not just that you're a whiner, but as Beth just said, it means you're litigious. Because if you file a public complaint and your employer sees it, what are the chances they won't say that's the reason, but no one wants to hire someone who they think may, in fact, sue them in federal or state court? So there's a lot of potential consequences. It's not as easy as it seems of watching, you know, Boston Legal just, you know, bring a claim, make lots of money, it all happens in an hour. It's a whole bunch of work and aggravation and risk. So I would counsel my own grown daughters, and I have, who have dealt with, as all young women do, who have dealt with in their various jobs while they've been in school, sexual harassment, hello. And the question is, and at times I've said to my own two daughters in their 20s, would you let, you know what daddy does, right? How about we, you know, you're working for this particular restaurant chain, you know, we could do something. And usually their response is, dad, I think I need to do this on my own and keep a job and figure out how to navigate the workplace. And I think that many women, for different reasons, feel that this is the world we live in. You just can't sue every guy who looks at you cross-eyed. So it becomes extremely, that's why I think Beth and I, when we're speaking to individuals who are going through this, it's not just let's sue them, you know, as our first response. You have to figure out an elegant way to deal with it. And sometimes it does not mean, often it doesn't mean filing a complaint. It might mean pushing back in the workplace and keeping a record of it and a paper trail so that you have proof that you've raised the issue. But everybody wants to de-escalate this. Our clients don't want to have a case that goes on for 10 years and involving forensic psychiatrists, etc.
Yeah, and I would add to that, I think one of the biggest myths about sexual harassment is that it's something that's rare and overt. I read somewhere that something like, 60% of working women, are in some way sexually harassed at one point or another in their career. So my own, two daughters, more likely than not, that they'll have to deal with these issues. This many women at some point experience it, and of course you don't see it that many times in the paper or in the courts, because it is a last resort situation, because the consequences can be so dire.
Well, I think that's a good point to get our only break in. Come back to your phone calls. I'm going to try to move beyond Roger Ailes as best I can, but I also, let's be productive in our second half hour and talk a little bit more about what Jack and Beth were just talking about. If you have been in this position, if you know someone who's been in this position, it's very difficult for all of the reasons we've discussed. What are the steps that they generally counsel? What are the things that we ought to be thinking about? We'll hit that. We've also had a pile of email come in. We'll get to some of your questions as well with Beth Cordello, chair of the employment law practice at Polano & Farrow in Rochester. And Jack Tuckner's on the line with us, an attorney focusing on women's rights in the workplace and a founding partner of one of the first firms to focus its practice on workplace gender rights. Short break and more connections next. Coming up in our second hour, when you think of the word charismatic, think about leaders in politics, business, or your community. How many people who come immediately to mind are women? Journalist Rebecca Traister, writing in New York Magazine, says, too often we turn charisma into a male quality and make it unattainable for women. Is that fair? Is it accurate? We'll talk about it next hour. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You want to call the program as we talk about the dynamics of sexual harassment in the workplace. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. First up is Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Evan, I think at first all of these men that do these things, I know I had a professor once, they're gentlemen at first. And when they, I guess they're perceptive enough to know when they might move to be more aggressive. And when they get you in a place where you truly have something to lose if you say no, that's when they really escalate. And I don't think the issue is about sex at all. It's about power. I can do this to you. I can make you do what you don't want to do. In my office or my class, you do not have the right to say no, and try complaining about it, because this particular person was highly charismatic, loved by his students. His classes were always very well filled. I never said a word, and he never really, I just ducked and dodged and eventually got through graduate school. But you do try these little things to avoid having to have a major confrontation, so you lose out on something that you value. And I understand perfectly well, because at first I thought he was great. He was funny. He was warm. All these things. You go around telling people, oh, this great professor. And then you feel like a fool later, and you're really embarrassed to tell friends even. So I understand all this completely, and it's about power, and it's about misogyny and entitlement that these people feel. Thank you.
All right, Jane, thanks for the phone call. Beth, is it about power?
Oh, absolutely. It's about power. I would completely agree with that.
Okay. Jack, power or sex?
Totally. It's all power. In fact, just to pick another celebrity who was in the news with a sex harassment case a few years ago, David Letterman, when he was accused and ultimately he was, held up by someone's boyfriend for $1 million to out him for sexual harassment. But the upshot was David Letterman, man earning $30 million a year, who was apparently having relations with a number of staffers that were earning $30,000 a year. But he was self-effacing, a nice guy, never threatened them. None of them were complaining. They would sleep with David Letterman. They said yes. They said no. Nothing ever happened to them. It was about because it he was not misabusing his power over these women. It doesn't change the fact, though, that the problem is the power relationship itself. When you can fire someone, that sets up a coercion. If your subordinate, if your direct report is hitting on you, what do? You fire him. You tell him where to get off. It's always about control and power, of course.
Sandra in Pittsford, next up. Go ahead, Sandra.
Well, it is all about power, and I'm 74. I've seen some of that. I remember a chief executive officer of a company made comments to people around as I stepped into his office for a meeting. He said, Sandra's going to come in here and play with me. And I ignored him. But today, I would say, listen, I'm here for a meeting. Why don't you explain to all these people who are not going to be playing? And I have a sister who's somewhat younger, and she took steps herself when somebody fondled her breast. She worked for a television company in Chicago. And when he did that, she just turned around and slammed him against the wall in some lockers, and he never bothered her again. And, you know, I think women have to decide whether they want to be cared for or just take care of themselves. And if you're earning $2 million and you're happy with being harassed, then go ahead and do it.
But Sandra, are you saying that if a woman decides to stay with the company despite harassment from a superior, they should not complain?
Well, they should complain legally if they want to. But, I mean, it's obvious that some women have gone along with it or put up with it thinking, well, something bad is going to happen to me. I'm going to lose my job. And there are people who've quit companies and gone on to get nice jobs. And there's something very degrading about just saying, you know, well, I have to put up with this. It's just smacks of the old school, and it is about power. And women do have power. It's just that in some cases they choose not to use it because they either don't dare or they're just comfortable having a lot of money, and, you know, they'll just say, oh, well, it's the way the boys are. So that just perpetuates that instead.
Well, Sandra, if you can hold on the line, I'd love to get a response from our guests. I'll start with Beth Cordello in studio. Go ahead, Beth.
Sure.
What respond to?
Well, I mean, I think the notion that that women have more power than they think, and that she referenced her sister, you know, pushing back physically and saying, you know, don't feel like you can't exercise power as a woman in the workplace, and that you don't have to put up with it. What do you think, Beth?
Well, I wish it were that simple, and sometimes it works. You know, when you stand up to the bully, he backs down, and it's over with, and you can go about your career, and sometimes that is the case. But, you know, her sister took a big risk. Her sister could have been fired, or he could have escalated his harassment of her. You just don't know how it's going to go, and all too often you experience retaliation in some form, whether it's you don't get the raise, you don't get the promotion, you know, up to being terminated for trumped up reasons.
Jack, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Beth. In some way, her sister was just really lucky. You can push back and suddenly you sort of show him who's boss, and that was it. But of course, she could have been fired immediately for an act of violence. And also the idea that you just quit, sure, you may quit and find a better job, but when you quit, you don't even collect unemployment benefits. You're not eligible. So it really is, for many people, it's tough out there. And it's just not so simple to quit and hope that you'll find another job.
All right, Sandra, what do you think?
Well, I'm not saying it's so simple, but I think that if more women just stood up, they don't necessarily need to punch somebody, but they can just turn on them and say, don't ever do that again. And probably there are a lot of men who wouldn't. It's a chance, but I think a lot of people would feel better about themselves unless, you know, they know they can't get another job and they're going to starve. I mean, there are a lot of options, and I've seen cases where people stood up for themselves in a law firm, for example, you know, being harassed and just saying, you know, don't say that to me again.
All right, Sandra, thank you for the phone call. Jack, go ahead.
I'm a big believer in women standing up for themselves in the workplace. I'm sure Beth would agree. I think, though, it just has to be done strategically. So if, for instance, a woman is dealing with unwelcome, unsolicited sexual conduct, and you sitting down with the perpetrator with a cup of coffee and explaining it to him, doing everything you can to say, please, I'm not interested, you're married, I'm married, I work for you, it's just not working out, please, let's remain professional. If that's going nowhere, you need to complain to the company. It needs to be in writing, and it should be so that you can prove that the company knows about this complaint, and then you have to allow the company to resolve it, which they must do. They have to investigate it promptly, and then they would, if they launch any kind of corrective action, that's the end of it. If there's then backlash as a result of the complaint, at least then this woman would have the potential of having a retaliation claim, because making it life worse for the complaining employee on the heels of a protected civil rights complaint is illegal. So it's very important, I'd say, don't quit and file a complaint with whomever, human resources. It could be the perpetrator himself if that's your company. He's one CEO and he's it. But you do want to not quit and give the company the opportunity to sort of face this allegation and see what it will do in response to that. You don't have to always, you don't have to sue and you don't have to quit, you don't have to punch him in the face, but you do need to give the company, it's always the company that you would be suing, not the perpetrator. You're not suing this individual, at least in federal court, you're suing the employer. So the employer has to be able to try to rectify it, and that's extremely important.
Beth, let me ask you on those same grounds then, if you're counseling a client on this, I know you agree, don't quit straight away. Don't necessarily resort to physical violence,
right?
And don't necessarily file a lawsuit right away. But is the first step to file that complaint with HR, or to at least go through that kind of a mechanism, or is it to have a one-on-one conversation with a potential harasser?
Well, it depends on the dynamics. And if you do have that conversation with the harasser, I would tell them to document it in some way, because if it doesn't go your way, it'll become a he said, she said situation.
And then you don't have the HR complaint.
Right. And then meanwhile, the employer has those, Christmas cards or thank you notes or nice emails.
Right.
And, that conversation couldn't have happened. So you have to document it in some way. And in New York, you can, many people don't know this, legally tape record a conversation if at least one party to that conversation is aware it's being recorded. Some women do that.
We call it a one-party consent state, listeners.
Right.
And by the way, journalists are very well aware of this. All that means is as long as you know it, I don't have to know it. And as long as I know it, you don't have to know it.
Right.
It just means you can secretly record a call is what it actually means. Go ahead, Jack.
But that's very important, because if you sit down with the perpetrator and you just say in your best actually interpersonal, forget I'm recording you conversation, please, when you said to me, Jimmy, yesterday that I'm so beautiful and you really think we should go out and you'd love to be with me, Well, it really upsets me and bothers me. And Jimmy says, well, I can't help myself. You're so beautiful. These are smoking gun corroborative statements. So it's important if you're trying to empower yourself and make sure that you're not going to be left holding an empty bag. And because it often is, women are the ones, when you complain about someone who brings in more money into the business, typically the perpetrator is more important to the company than the victim. And often there is this natural tendency to kind of want to, to sort of let's excise this little tumor while it's still two cells before it metastasizes. And that little tumor is the complaining person, because the company sees the complaining person now as a time bomb, someone who might actually, end up suing the company. So that's why it's just so important to deal with it sort of eloquently and only raise the ante, if you will, as needed. But definitely putting it in writing, not threat, not saying I'll see you in court, but just saying to your company, please help me with this. So-and-so is subjecting me to this and that and said this and he's doing this and I'm upset about it. Please meet with me. That type of record that you keep, even if you're just sending emails to follow up, will go a long way towards it. If it doesn't get resolved in your favor somehow that you can still work there, Beth and I would probably look at that and say at least you'll be able to separate and teach them a lesson and have something perhaps more than an apology to show for it.
All right, back to the phones. Deb in Rochester. Go ahead, Deb.
Hi. I think what I have to say really supports what the panelists are saying. I had an experience where coworkers were telling me that an executive in our office was making sexual comments about me behind my back. And so when I learned that, I confronted him directly and said, you know, I've heard about this, and I really want you to stop because it's not professional and it's not legal. And he said, well, it was all in good fun. I said, well, it's not fun for me. Mm-hmm. And again, it isn't legal, and if you don't stop, I'll have to take further action.
Did that stop it, Deb, to your knowledge? It did.
It did.
And you never felt that there was any sort of retaliation for your speaking out in that case?
No, I did not feel like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you document that conversation?
No, that's a good question. No, I did not. And I'll tell you what, this was like in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And we really weren't as aware and as confident in our abilities as women, I think, to stand up for ourselves then. I mean, I was pretty proud of myself for doing that, going that far. I think today I would know to document that, yes.
Well, Deb, thank you for the phone call. And Beth, sounds like she handled it really, really well, other than the fact that, you know, as she says, today, make sure you're documenting each step, as Jack said. You agree with that, Beth?
Right, right. And what she's describing is, you know, what Jack or I would call a locker room mentality or a boys club, and that's where there's a pervasively hostile work environment where no one may be necessarily hitting on you per se, but there's, you know, these sexually hostile jokes and so forth that aren't necessarily aimed at you, but it just sets a tone in the workplace.
And on that note, I want to shift the conversation to a question a listener had about the difference between a sort of a quid pro quo, a demand of sex for promotion or sex for salary. That is what we're essentially hearing in some cases with Roger Ailes and what we've seen in other cases, versus that locker room sort of sexually charged, uncomfortable atmosphere. And Jack, you know, the listener who had written the email was asking, is that the same thing? I mean, or is it all sexual harassment? Because I think they were thinking sexual harassment is sex for favors, sex for promotion. But it's broader than that. Fair, Jack?
Yes, it's essentially one thing now. I mean, if one feels that in some way the conditions or the terms of your employment are degraded, it's become a so-called severely hostile work environment because of who you are as a woman. That's why, not just because your boss is a jerk. He's allowed to be a jerk. In fact, he could be completely profane and have a potty mouth as long as he's somewhat equal opportunity potty mouth jerk. But if you're being sort of singled out and subjected to sexism, misogyny, it's because of who you are as a female that you're experiencing this. I don't think it doesn't really matter whether or not you feel it is a request to engage physically or simply too many disgusting jokes or objectification or misogyny, hatred, which is, you know, prevalent. It's all sex discrimination.
Okay. Bethan, generally speaking, for clients who've come to you, clients who have been victims of sexual harassment, is the majority of sexual harassment this kind of locker room stuff versus the actual quid pro quo, or is it the other way around?
I wouldn't say it's far more of one than the other. Mm-hmm. I think they're both very typical.
And Mary Madeline, who is a Republican strategist, she was responding on this. She made a comment on this that I thought was strange. I thought it was attacking a straw man. What she essentially told the Washington Post in an email was that she fears that women want to be treated too delicately. And I don't think anybody is saying that, but here's what she wrote. She wrote, quote, "To us, sexism at the workplace was not being treated as roughly or honestly as men. Politics and TV are not places for sugar cubes," end quote. I don't really know what that sugar cube thing is, but what I read that as her way of saying, hey, if there's a little bit of language that's a little more sexually charged or a little more locker room and men are willing to engage with it with you, it just means they're treating you like the guys, and that's part of the modern work. I mean, I guess I don't want to infer too much from Mary Madeline. It was a very strange comment. I'll start with you, Jack. What do you make of that?
I don't know what I make of that. I just know, I don't, just seems to me it's certainly sexism if you're talking about being treated more gingerly versus being treated what feminism is equality, right? And seems to me we're also dealing with a culture right now, and I believe you did a show on it recently, where this somewhat inexplicable misogyny, right, on the, you know, the Ghostbusters,
yep.
You have all of this, you know, with Leslie Jones, I believe her name was,
yep.
Who got out of Twitter because of the obscene, the profanity, the absolute crazy racist, sexist, violent conduct on behalf of lots of people that seem to have still an extremely intense response to women simply because they're women. You could bring up Hillary Clinton herself now as an exemplar of this. So I think that it's beyond simply whether boys will still be boys in the workplace. We have this problem, because I wonder, what is it about women still earning 75% you know, 75% of what men earn? Most, you don't have to be a feminist to still wonder, what is it about everybody who presumably has a sister, a wife, a mother, a daughter who they're fond of, that makes women still second class, that makes the hatred of women and the treating of women differently still accepted in our culture? I mean, I think that's sort of the underlying street harassment, misogyny. It seems to be alive and well. And so when it just comes out with a situation like this where we're reminded that men still have a sense of entitlement, and men still feel that they need to be in control. Even if you're Donald Trump and you give a woman power to run your organization, at the end of the day, you're still the one who holds the keys to the kingdom.
Yeah, and Beth, Mary Madeline seems to be saying that, hey, guys, if you're going to speak in a sexually charged way and treat it like a locker room when you're with the guys and I'm around, don't treat it any differently. I'm here to... And I don't think that was really the point of all of this. I mean, it felt...
No, you know, that comment to me struck with the criticism I hear of, you know, people who don't like the Black Lives Matter movement because they're seeking special treatment. And that's the misconception. It's not special
right.
treatment that's being sought. It's just equal treatment.
Equal treatment.
A seat at the same
right.
table as everyone else. You know, Black Lives Matter too is really what they're saying. And, you know, in the same here, you know, women don't necessarily want to be treated special. They just want the same equal opportunities and compensation in the workplace.
Exactly.
Here's an email from a listener named Alan who writes, Hi, Evan. I have to believe that like allegations of rape, allegations of sexual harassment turn out to be grounded in fact the vast majority of the time. I admit I don't know if this is the case, but I'm wondering what the law says about producing evidence. I don't write to take the side of harassers. God knows I can't stand Roger Ailes. I'm just wondering what the legal standard for proving harassment is. I'll start with you, Beth.
It's on the complainer. They have the burden of proof. Which is also what makes this an uphill battle for so many complainants, because, of course, the company has a huge war chest to pay an army of lawyers if needed. They have a ton of documentation, and that's why, you know, women in the situation are told time and again by lawyers, please document, because that is all you'll have, you know, should you pursue this legally, and you carry the burden of proof. And all the employer has to do is articulate some legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for why they did whatever they did. And it could be, well, she was, you know, late to work a few times. And then, you know, the ball's back in your court to prove why that's a pretext or, you know, a smokescreen for illegal discrimination.
Okay, Jack?
Yeah, this would not... I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead, Jack.
It wouldn't be a strong case, probably, all of the things being equal, if these were regular people, because at least my limited understanding of it is there was no corroboration, there was no prior complaint, and there was your ratings are down, we're firing you, and now she's going to complain. That would normally be not the best way to proceed with a case. What's the evidence? Her statement, her testimony is evidence. But that's all the evidence there is, and she's kind of a dollar short and a day late. If this first came after there was an adverse employment action, i.e. her non-renewal of her contract, where she said, by the way, I think it's because I didn't sleep with you, that's not the strongest way to proceed with a claim, typically.
All right, Danielle writes to us on Twitter, why do women who are sexually harassed stay with their companies? Because even if it wasn't her fault, there is always a sense of guilt and shame that she did something to cause it. End the shame. That's from Danielle on Twitter. Some final thoughts from our guests. And Jack, I've been introducing you as an attorney focusing on women's rights in the workplace and a founding partner of one of the first firms to focus its practice on workplace gender rights. Why don't you tell the audience, got about a minute and a half here, why don't you tell the audience a little bit more about what it is that you do and where you do it?
Well, what I do is represent employees. I'm basically an employee rights lawyer, but my particular concentration is on gender-specific issues such as sexual harassment, gender pay disparity, and pregnancy discrimination, the sort of perennial favorite of employers to sort of, you know, get into trouble with. because women, once women are with child, once they're going to be out for 3 months, there tends to be a sort of a diminution in women's standing in the workplace. So we support and empower and represent women who find themselves in challenging workplace situations, either to try to help them change course, and sometimes that occurs, and if it can't, to help them to separate where they're not, you know, they're sort of riding off into the sunset with something that allows them some time to be able to find another job that suits them better, and also having taught the employers some, hopefully, some lesson in sort of gender relations and how they should treat their employees.
Well, thanks for taking the time for the program this hour, Jack. Insightful stuff, and we certainly appreciate it.
Well, you're quite welcome. Anytime.
Attorney Jack Tuckner with us. Beth Cordello, who is the chair of the employment law practice at Polano & Farrow. If you go to her website, you seem to have dozens of different legal practice specialties, but I know you've represented employees, employers as well, and I know it's a busy calendar for you, so thank you for fitting us in. I know you're headed back to Polano & Farrow now, but thank you for being here, Beth.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, Beth Cordello, Jack Tuckner joining us. Got to as many of your calls as we could. Interesting stuff this hour. Let's get our short break and much more Connection straight ahead.
Program.